get started. So last time I showed you a way to infer a Schrodinger equation. And then we started talking about the interpretation of the wave function and discussed what was Born's statistical interpretation. So the equation we inferred looked like that. It took us about one lecture to get there. It seemed like it's very simple to get there, but the first time Schrodinger did it, it actually took him a few months. And this is just the second order differential equation that once solved gives us the wave function, and then we use the probabilistic interpretation and write probability density as that wave function squared. And really, there's no mathematical way to prove this equation. There's no way to derive it from classical physics. So the actual proof comes from using it and seeing that its results agree with the experimental measurements. So the Schrodinger equation tells you how the wave function slowly evolves with time. And say at some time t, the wave function looks like that. And then sometime dt later, the wave function looks slightly different. Where how much it's different, you can calculate exactly from the Schrodinger equation. And this slow and gradual evolution happens until the time you take a measurement. And we considered measuring position, so measuring x. With the position of our particle, say you look where the particle is, and at some time you see it at this measured place. At that moment, your Schrodinger equation does not govern the evolution anymore. The wave function actually collapses. Particle is really there. You measured it there. It's really there. And if you measure where it is again sometime dt later, it will still be there. What we want to consider instead is doing repeated measurements where the system with your particle is prepared in the same time. So do the same preparation procedure. You measure where the particle is, and you get some position, and then you do that all again. You prepare the system in the exactly same way, measure the position, and say possibly get some different position of the particle. What is the average place you find the particle at after repeating many such measurements? And for the average, I'm going to write, instead of a bar on top, this angle brackets around the average that the quantity is of. And this is going to start making much more sense once we get into the formalism. So the average position after many measurements is results of each individual of the many measurements times the probability of getting that result. Summed over many, many measurements. And if distribution of possibilities continues like that, or if you do many, many measurements, this can be just written out as an integral instead of a sum where the result of the measurement is just that position, your measuring position, and the probability of the particle being at that position, we just write with our probability density. So the way to calculate an average just of position in quantum mechanics is just integrate over x times the probability of being at that particular x. So we call this the expectation value. Of x, because that's what we expect to get as an average after we do many, many measurements of x. In a similar way, you can get the expectation value of any function of x. So say, instead of measuring where the particle is, you build some elaborate apparatus that will measure a particular function of x. So say, this device can tell you exactly what is x squared times e to the minus 2x. You have some piece of equipment that measures this functional position. Then after you do many measurements with this piece of equipment, the average of all the measured values is the expectation value of this f of x. And you just calculate it in a very similar way, where you average over if each possible value f of x times the probability of getting that particular value and over all the possible x's. Okay. Any questions about that? So because this probability distribution changes in time, how does the expectation value of position change in time? So what this means is that they have to differentiate that integral that defines our expectation value of position like that. Okay. So to differentiate this integral, I have to bring that dt under the integral sign. And dt is not going to differentiate x. X and t are two independent variables. Our wave function is a function of these two independent variables that don't depend on each other. So this is not like in classical mechanics, where you can do something like that and get the velocity. So instead, dt is just going to differentiate the wave function. Because the wave function depends both on position and on time, I'm writing a partial derivative instead of the total like that. All right. So now we have this partial derivative of the probability density. We had that in the last lecture. What we did was first wrote this psi square as really a product, then used the product rule differentiated either psi star or psi and then use Schrodinger equation to replace the time derivative with the spatial derivative and the potential. All right, so all those steps again. And if you feel like you couldn't repeat those steps right now, just go home and look over it. So doing all those steps, instead of this time derivative gave me an x derivative. So what I did is replace that time derivative with this. Okay. In the case in the last lecture, there wasn't this extra x floating around, but I'm not doing anything with that. I'm just doing all the same steps with this time derivative like in the last lecture. Any questions about that? All right. So last time, we didn't have this x. So we just had an integral of a total derivative and we were done. Now we're not done because of that extra x. So what we need to do is integration by parts. Thanks. Yep, totally.
I h bar over 2m.
Thank you. Okay, so now that constants are all right, let's do the integration by parts. And where integration by parts comes from is just the product rule. So say that you have two functionals of x, f and g. When I'm taking a derivative of that product of f and g, I can either differentiate f or g. Like that. So what we have here is a function of x times a derivative. We have something that looks like this last term. So that last term is this total derivative minus the other term. So now I'm going to put this product rule under an integral sign. And actually, let me put some arbitrary limits of integration a and b instead of the infinities. So this integral of the total derivative is just the function evaluated at our limits, and then minus the other integral, where now the differential is not on g, but on f. So I need to do that with these two functions. My f is just x, and my g is everything inside that parenthesis. So psi star the derivative minus psi times the derivative. Okay. So the first term I should get instead of this integral is something that looks like f times g evaluated at my limits. Okay, so I want to argue that that term, once evaluated at the infinities, goes to zero. We know that psi goes to zero at x going to either infinity in order to be square integrable. But x, or our function f, does not go to zero at either infinity. So how do we know that this product goes to zero? Well, first, remember that psi goes to zero at least as fast as x to the power of minus 1/2. At either infinity. What does that tell you about the product x times psi? Does it go to zero? Well, not necessarily, right? Because x times that is just x to the power of 1/2. And as x goes to infinity, that can go to infinity. So that doesn't work. We really need to look into these derivatives as well. So if psi goes to zero at least this fast, how fast must the derivative of psi go to zero? Well, at least as fast as derivative of that. Which is like x to the minus 3/2. And now what we have looks kind of like x times psi times the derivative of psi. And that's like x over x squared, and it really does go to zero at either infinity. So I'm going to drop that total derivative term. This like term is zero, and instead I'm just going to have the other integral. The other integral tells me, well, first there's a minus sign, and then I need to differentiate my f. Differentiating f is just 1, dx dx, and then my g looks like this. Have the minus sign, and df dx is just 1, and then I have my g. Okay, so simplifying this even further, I want to do another integration by parts, and I'm just going to do it in this term. So doing another integration by parts in that term, again, I get something that's a total derivative of, in this case, just psi star that we know vanishes as both psi and psi star go to zero at infinity. And the other term that instead of derivative on psi star has a derivative on psi, which is just what we have here. Okay, let's write that out just in case it's confusing. So I'm just doing this term, the second term, in there. So just integrating that second term, and I'm doing it using integration by parts. Now this is my f and that is my g, just psi and psi star. And I get total derivative of that. Probability density, and then the derivative on psi instead of psi star. Yeah, and we know this vanishes. At either infinity. So instead of this term, I'm getting yet another of these terms by moving this derivative onto psi. And now that I have 2 of psi star times derivative of psi, I can just cancel this power of 2, and I'm left with minus I h bar over m, and then an integral. Of that quantity. Just psi star times d psi dx. Any questions about that? Right. So what they calculated here is how the expectation value of position changes in time. It's not really how position changes in time, as the position is not really well defined, but this is what we're going to think about as expectation value of velocity. The velocity of this particle is not really something we can talk about. We don't know where it is until we measure it. So how fast is it moving? Well, on average, it's moving as fast as expectation value of position is moving. So if this expression gives me the expectation value of velocity, then the expectation value of momentum, which is something we know more about, we know it's conserved, we know how force is affected, is just m times that. So just canceling that m in the denominator. And we get the expectation value of momentum. So what does that mean? That if I measure momentum of a particle many times, the average of those repeated measurements on the system that was prepared in the exactly same way every time would, on average, give me this value. So let me rewrite how we calculated the expectation value of position. In order to make it look a little more similar to that expression, so expectation value of position looks like that. But now I'm just going to write my x in between psi star and psi. Psi star, then I multiply it with x, then I multiply it with psi, and I integrate that over the whole space.
Yes. What's the significance of putting it between?
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to make it look more similar as this expectation value of momentum. So let me rewrite expectation value of momentum in the exactly same way, where I have this integral, and then first I have psi star. And then I have everything else, which involves this minus I h bar. Instead of minus I, I'm going to write 1 over I. And then next thing I need to do is differentiate. So I'm just going to write that derivative, which is going to act on everything to the right of it, being psi. Right. So all I did here is I wrote these two integrals to look exactly the same. So that they're in the x integral, I'm sandwiching x between psi star and psi. And putting x there just means multiplying with x. It doesn't matter in which order I do multiplication. I can put it on either side, it would still work. In the case of p, the momentum, it actually matters where this derivative is. So I have to keep it there in the middle, and I'm just going to do that consistently and keep it in the middle. So instead of x, there is an x. Instead of p, there's this derivative. So that derivative is what we're going to call the p operator in quantum mechanics. And whenever there is an operator, I'm going to try, if it's confusing at all, I'm going to try this, to put this hat on it just to make sure that we're not talking about either expectation value or the dynamical variable that exists in classical mechanics, so the classical counterpart of this. So say for x, the operator is just x itself. It doesn't really operate, it just multiplies. It's a very simple operation. And it doesn't really matter if I write this hat. It's still the same. If I wrote it just like that, it would look like a number that stands for p. Question? Huh? Yeah, you could define psi star. Psi star. You wanted me to take a conjugate of this? Oh, psi star. Oh, yeah, definitely, sorry. Psi star is the complex conjugate. Okay. So if psi looked like, I don't know, e to the minus I phi times I, whatever, I x times, I don't know, some. I need some numbers, but here. It looks like this. Say this is your psi. So everything that's real stays real for psi star. All the signs of I are switched. So just complex conjugation operation. Switch all the signs of I. Okay, any other questions? All right, so we got into operators. And so far we have two, one for X, one for P. And it turns out that's all we need. If you try to do classical mechanics again, you can do everything knowing only position and momentum. Every dynamical variable, everything that changes as the time progresses, you can write everything in classical mechanics as a function of X and P. Let me call this function O. So now, going to quantum mechanics, instead of all these functions we had in classical mechanics of X and P, we're going to replace every single one of these functions by the equivalent operator. And we're going to do that just by replacing X with X operator, or nothing, not doing anything, and replacing P with P operator, or this derivative. And then, if you need to calculate what is the expectation value of this classical dynamical variable, so what would you get if you measure that many times? What is the average? You would calculate that expectation value by sandwiching this expression written now in terms of operators between psi star and psi and integrating over the full space, the same way we did it for X and for P by themselves. So let's do an example. Very simple example where we're going to look into kinetic energy. Kinetic energy in classical mechanics is just P squared over 2m. So I want to instead write this as an operator, like P operator squared over 2m. And the P operator is right there. I just need to square that. So I get minus h bar squared over 2m. And then two derivatives with respect to x. Okay, so how would you calculate the expectation value of many measurements of kinetic energy? Just by sandwiching this operator for kinetic energy in between psi star and psi. Okay. So let me just pull all those constants in front. Minus h bar squared over 2m in front of the integral. So what does the integral say? It says, first differentiate psi twice, then multiply with psi star, and then integrate over the whole space. Which I?
Like earlier on, you, for the momentum operator, you took negative I from the outside and brought it in as 1 over I.
Right. Oh, negative I is 1 over I, yeah?
Right, but if you square negative I, you get plus 1.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you square 1 over I, you have
plus. Yeah, so this is, it's actually very similar to our, if you square I, you get minus 1, yes. Or negative I.
But if you square negative I?
You still get minus 1. Yes, because if you square the minus sign, you get 1, and then you're just squaring the I. All right. Okay. Maybe that class before this class will become useful. You operate twice, yeah. Really, I should be writing this. You're right.
Yeah, okay.
And then the first, so this is the p squared, right? And then there is the left one. I'm just going to write it out. And then there is the right one. I'm going to write it out. And then there are all these constants. You can just pull them in front. And this means differentiate twice. Exactly. Yes.
Can you describe quantitatively the amount of time it takes for a collapsed wave function to return to the waveform described by Turing?
To the wave. Right. Yeah, it depends on its energy. So, right. In principle, this collapsed wave function now has all of the energies. Or it has a particular energy. But how fast the time spreads depends on its energy. That is something you will learn. You will definitely learn more about it. Delta function is one of those things that we know how to integrate, like the Gaussian, but even easier. So we use it a lot in our examples. Yes?
Once you collapse the wave function, it doesn't matter how long you wait, you always get the same measurement.
Nope, because now your wave function is like your initial state. Like, so now, say this is your delta function, right? And say that I'm just going to start measuring time from now, when it's delta function. Okay, so then you let that time evolve with the Schrodinger equation. And it's going to spread. Or how it's going to behave depends on the potential. But yes, in principle, if you let some longer than infinitesimal amount of time pass, you won't necessarily always find a delta function. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Why does that work? Like, why for the kinetic energy is p squared over 2m?
Mm-hmm. Over 2m, yeah?
Yeah, over 2m. Like, why does that work? And then, does that exist also in
there's a lot of things in quantum mechanics that seem weird. If you tell me how it seems weird to you, I might be able to describe it better. But. Well, so I'm trying to justify it because it worked for these two examples. And then before we learn anything more about the formalism, you can just take this as prescription. You always put it in the middle. You stop it between psi star and psi so it can act only on psi.
So it can act on psi star? Just a question.
In principle, it could. And definitely does say, like, if it now did an integration by parts, you would be moving those derivative on the Psi star. But this is the way that works. All right, so let me do another example. As in this example, we only had a function of momentum, so only derivatives. So let me consider the full energy instead, which is the sum of kinetic plus potential. And potential is some function of x, possibly time. It's just the potential energy. So what we have here is energy, just in classical mechanics, that's a function of both momentum and position. So if I'm going to write this energy as an operator, the operator that corresponds to energy we call the Hamiltonian. So I'm going to write H with hat on top. So that's the operator for energy. And then I need to replace the momentum with momentum operator. And I need to replace the position with position operator, which is just position, basically. And then there are two terms here. One looks exactly like the one we had before, the kinetic energy term. And then another term that has the potential just as a function of x. Okay, so how do I calculate the expectation value of energy? Meaning, what is the average of many measurements of energy on the system that was prepared in the exactly same way is by sandwiching that stuff between psi and psi star. So psi star, and then that whole term, h bar square over 2m, second derivative with respect to x, plus v of x, all acting on psi. All right, so the thing is that we already saw exactly the same stuff acting on psi. Where did you see that? That is exactly what shows up in our Schrodinger equation. That's a wonderful sound. Right, so our Schrodinger equation looks like IH bar and then time derivative of psi equals exactly this. H bar square over 2m, second derivative with respect to x, plus the potential that all acting on psi. So what we see here is a much shorter way to write our Schrodinger equation, as that term on the right is just the Hamiltonian acting on the wave function. Okay, so I'm writing that with the understanding that there is possibly a momentum and position inside the Hamiltonian, and that you have to follow this prescription where you replace every appearance of position by position, and every appearance of momentum by h bar over I times the derivative with respect to position. Okay, and agreeing on this prescription, this is a very compact way to write our Schrodinger equation. In terms of operators. Time derivative, no. Any other questions? All right, so I just did two examples. But in principle, any classical dynamical quantity you can write out in terms of position and momentum. So say angular momentum as we move in out of 1D will be such a dynamical quantity that is just the cross product of position and momentum. And it depends on both of them. So this will have all three terms, x, y, z. And then in order to calculate the expectation value of such an operator, so what you get if you do many repeated measurements, you have to sandwich the operator version just by following this prescription of that dynamical quantity between psi star and psi and integrate over the whole space. So what we're talking about here are like various consequences of the lack of certainty in classical mechanics. Because we don't know exactly what the position is at any given time, we have an expectation value of position similar for momentum or for energy. Even though the wave function is completely determined and there is nothing indeterministic about Schrödinger equation, the probabilistic interpretation makes us have to take these expectation values to know the results for all our classical quantities. So a way to measure, to express numerically that lack of certainty is a standard deviation. Commonly used to explain the shape of an exam statistics. So now we know what the expectation value, the mean, the average of measuring position is. However, every time you measure position, you don't get necessarily this position. So to measure the deviation from this mean, we want to say how much the measured x's are far away from the average. So I want to average that, the deviation from the mean, but if I actually averaged, I would just get a zero, right? Because there's as many x's that are smaller and as there are many that are larger than the x, this just averages to zero. So to actually measure the distance of a measured x from the mean x, I need to take an absolute value or square it, or somehow take a positive quantity that depends on this distance. Absolute value doesn't behave well. You can't differentiate it at zero. So the square is actually our easiest answer. So now if I average that, I know the deviation from the mean. And because I've already squared this expression, so right, that is now like meters squared, I need to take a square root to get the average deviation from the mean. And this is what we call the standard deviation of x in this case, or the root mean square for this distribution. So let me just expand that square. So under the square root, I have the expectation value of x squared minus 2 times x times the average x, and then plus the average x squared. Okay, so that's what I'm averaging, those three terms, every one of them. And that one is just a number. We already averaged the x. We can call it the mean, the expectation value of x. Okay. So let's do this averaging. First, I'm averaging x squared. So I'm calculating the expectation value of x squared. right? This is like a function of x, that is x squared. The way I calculate the expectation value of x squared is by sandwiching x squared between psi star and psi and integrating over the whole space. The second term, well, has this constant too, has this other constant that's the average of x, and then I need to average x, so that gives me yet another average of x. And then the last term is just a constant. Okay, and those two terms together, they both look like average of x then squared. Together, they just give me a single term that's average of x squared with a minus sign. Okay, so what that means is I need to subtract an average of x, so just x sandwiched between psi star and psi, integrated over the whole space. That's average of x, and then that squared. First calculate the integral, then take a square. Subtract that from the integral that has x squared in it. And then, taking the square root, I get the standard deviation of x. Okay?
Yes. A lot of these things kind of like it was made out of like convenience because calculus is easier on squares and square roots than on absolute values rather than like something that's like fundamental. Could you have done it like with to the fourth and then the fourth root or something?
Yeah, you
and
can.
And you'd have like
yes.
similar identities and like the uncertainty principle of like
sure. You don't get the uncertainty principle anymore.
But you would get like a similar thing with a different definition, probably.
Yep, you would probably get a similar thing, right? Mm-hmm. So you can once talking about distributions, there's various things you can calculate, various numbers you can associate with this distribution in order to describe it. This is the next one. Right after the average, this is the next easiest one to calculate. And this one measures the spread of the distribution. And why is that important to us is because now our distributions really are spread. Except for that just collapsed wave function right after the measurement, where the standard deviation for that delta function is zero, every other possible wave function will have more or less spread, and we can actually describe the wave function with that number. Okay? So a small sigma means that all the points are very close to each other, all the points measured, and a large sigma means they're very spread out. Okay, I'll stop there. Feel free to stay if you have any questions.